Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is artist and painter Deborah Birmingham. Birmingham is a graduate of the University of Washington at Seattle, where she received her MFA, and a graduate of Cornell University, where she received her BFA. Her work has been shown in many art spaces and galleries, including the Art Institute of Chicago, the Johnson Museum at Cornell University, the Arnott Art Museum in Elmira, New York, and the Memorial Art Gallery at the University of Rochester. She has also shown her work at the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington, Delaware, and has a longtime affiliation with D.C. Moore Gallery in New York City. All right, well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, you said in your artist statement that your life has been defined by your connection to the natural world. Tell us about that.
I think that as young people growing up in the vintage that I am from, where I played outside, unencumbered by adult supervision for hours and weeks and years upon end, I indulged in basically behaving like a naturalist. I studied ants and what they did, and birds and frogs, and I caught snakes, and I climbed trees.
Wow.
And it all sort of wrapped around who I was and continued to be in such a way that when I was 17, I had the great fortune to go to Wyoming, where I participated in outdoor course called Knowles. It's similar to Outward Bound.
Oh.
And it's very rigorous. You go on a survival where you spend basically a week without food, and you have to find your own sustenance, and you have to find your way in the wilderness. And it was a defining moment for me because I basically was enraptured by having this sort of very intense physicality coupled with beauty and camaraderie. And I think that it really changed who I became as an adult.
Wow, that is amazing.
Okay. Well, then the other part of that is that I think I began to make choices in my life that were predicated by this absorption and love of being in the outdoors. And when I was getting my MFA degree in Seattle, I very narrowly managed to finish because I had become so engrossed and involved with mountain climbing. All of the volcanoes in that region, in the Cascades, I climbed, and it was very intense. And I even climbed Mount Rainier, which is 14,400
yes.
feet, and it was very technical and very challenging. And again, it was very engrossing to me and had similar aspects of what it is to work step by step in your studio, making statements where you have a sort of a quest to achieve a goal. And it's not necessarily the final product, but it's all that goes into it.
Yeah.
That is.
You know what I'm curious about, too? I mean, when did you start painting and incorporating that into this love of the natural world and climbing and all these activities?
Well, I would have to say I am one of those artists that, why is the sky blue? You know, I just came out that way. And from a little girl onward, it was just clear in my mind that if an adult asked me as a four-year-old what I wanted to be when I grew up, I knew I was going to be an artist. And
wow,
this is what I would say.
That's amazing.
How I have shifted it now through the course of my life, I would add an addendum, which would be that, and vigneron, which means I grow grapes and make wine.
And I'm going to mention that because it's part of your art.
It is.
Right?
It is. It's two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about that, too. It's called the Bloomer Creek Gallery.
Bloomer Creek Vineyard. Bloomer Creek Vineyard. It is basically, we're wine growers, my husband and I. We, at this point now, have two different vineyard sites. We have 10 acres on the west side of Cayuga Lake, which was where we began. We now have 10 acres planted there. And then we have an additional vineyard on the east side of Seneca Lake, which is where we also have our production cellar tasting room. And we have the potential for 12 acres there, and at the moment, 8 are planted. And it was a site that had been abandoned for 30 years, and we reclaimed it. We basically cleared all the old vines and trellis and overgrown shrubs and trees, and in 2013 inaugurated the vineyard that is now called Barrow Vineyard. It's a name that I chose because in Old Norse, Barrow means high rocky hill, which is what the beautiful vineyard is. And it also means burial mound. And it actually, I chose that name because it is where my parents' ashes are spread. Wow. And it was their, basically their estate that enabled me to buy the vineyard.
Wow, that's, God, what an incredible story. What a great place for an artist. Now, you know, you talk about the natural world, you talk about your interest in climbing and being out in nature, but your paintings are very muted, very ghost-like. Mm-hmm. You use the color blue mm-hmm. often. Mm-hmm. Where is that coming from?
That, where to begin? The palette choice is sort of my natural inclination. I just exult in the nuances of subtle shift of warm and cool and nuance of color. It's to me, it's a similar, what kind of music do you like? Mm. You know, what kind of poetry, you know, reads to you and makes sense? Uh-huh. And I was very fortunate that I ended up through twists of fate being in the art program at Cornell, because it was in an era when, yet again, painting was dead, and I knew I wanted to be a painter, and very fortunately, I landed in like a little rebel outpost of painters, and the art department was headed by a woman who was a beloved friend, and at that time, mentor teacher, Jillian Peterson Craig, who is now here again, fortunately. I see her more. Mm. The other side of being at Cornell is that Cornell is known for having a renowned Asian art collection.
Yes.
So through twists of fate, rather than concentrating on medieval or Renaissance art as a young art student, I was just enamored and enthralled with the Chinese and Japanese Sumi ink paintings, calligraphy uh-huh. and paintings, a huge sense of asymmetry and empty space. And it was an immediate evocative connection for my own view of how I wanted to transcribe what yeah. I saw. But getting to the choice of blues and grays in my palette, as I began to work between landscape and also studio interiors, which all my work is observational, meaning that I will paint from what I'm seeing. Mm. It would not be necessarily fair to say that my goal ultimately was to do an absolute recreation of reality. More, it was a foil for talking about memory and dream and how we navigate the world in life. And I began to use, I had found a set of lead knights that were in, they were from the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And I began to arrange them in very spare arrangements with other studio objects, not because I wanted to paint toys necessarily, but I wanted to start sort of a conversation and a narrative about the quest and how that is a part of life. And by using toys, I realized that one, as an artist, walks a fine line of nostalgia being the predominant sort of motivation in what is being perceived. And I didn't want a nostalgic look at toys like, oh, I wish I were there again. Rather, I was very much trying to relate how moments from our childhood do not evaporate and disappear.
Absolutely.
They tend to, perhaps for most people, they're not ever present. In my particular life, I've been able to sort of keep all of my memories ever present, probably because I'm preoccupied with it as a subject matter in my aesthetics. But that said, there's also sort of an aerial perspective that I employed. And that was an effort to use subject matter at a remove and a distance so that you could be sort of involved in the sense of play as a child without being that child. Mm.
You know what I have found looking at your work? It seems haunted to me.
Yes. Well,
are you haunted?
Well,
in
it's
some
curious
way?
You say that, because the other part of my life has been moving. No, I never expected when I received my MFA in Seattle. From there, I was basically going around the world. I was living in the Caribbean for 2 years. I lived in St. Croix. I was living in Vermont. And I never expected, except for through twists of fate, that I met my now husband. And he was determined to grow grapes and make wine in the Finger Lakes. So I, in my very adventurous self, said, okay, and moved into this old farmhouse with him, which actually the creek behind the farmhouse is Bloomer Creek. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that it was at such a time, it was in the early 80s, and there had been a heyday for agriculture in upstate New York that is ever so slowly evaporating. Not to say that it's not still vital, but it has shifted. It used to be, when I was first there, that there were many small farmers. They all had jobs elsewhere to support the farm, but they had like second and third generation farms that they were trying to maintain. And in the span of 30, 35 years that I've been living there, it basically has shifted to Amish farms and one or two large crop farmers where they own thousands of acres, and the Amish have the small farms.
So are you haunted by all of this?
Yes. So for when we first came here and lived here in these old farmhouses, the farmhouse on the Bloomer Creek was built in the 1870s. There are a lot of old farmhouses around. In the early days of the 80s, we could go for walks in the back fields, and there would be an abandoned house. Nobody, you know, the windows are busted out, but old nutshells and seeds and little scraps of paper and lace curtains would be hanging and blowing in the wind. And I feel that it began to sort of become a part of what I was transcribing in my artwork. I was reacting to sort of the disappearance of a way of life and people. When I first moved here, there was a woman named Susie Meyer. She died at 97. And you speak of being haunted. At one point, when she died in when she was 97, there had been a period in her life when she was 3 years old that she lived in the house that was my farmhouse on Bloomer Creek. And Kim and I had gone to Grandma Susie's funeral. And when we came back from the funeral, down in the carriage house, there was this really odd situation where there was an open barn doorway, and there was this beautiful Cooper's hawk that was just sitting on the ground in the open doorway, and it sort of stared at us, and then it would launch itself and fly amongst the rafters and then land on the ground again, and it did it over and over again. And I have to say that it seemed not a coincidence that Grandma Susie's spirit was coming back to a part of her childhood.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Birmingham, and she is an artist, and we're talking about her fabulous work. Now, I want to ask you, why do you think visual art is still so popular in the culture? I mean, we've got the internet and we've got people moving so fast, but people still love to go to galleries.
That's an interesting question that you're posing, because I think that people do. However, I feel that with the advent of iPhones and photography that is ubiquitous and everybody is taking hundreds of pictures a day, and that it has really changed how we view visual information. And I am a believer that we have been making art since forever, as we as a creature, you know, the cave paintings of Lascaux, you know, they're beautiful and they're meaningful as much as the Sistine Chapel. And what I can tell you is that as a painter, I began to see a shift when if you are actually creating something for people to look at out of nothing, out of a white canvas, it is like a magic trick. And there is an enormous amount of visual trickery involved that is learned technique and a commitment to your craft. And over the years, I have found that, for instance, in our tasting room in Hector, I had hung for a while a pastel I had done of the view above Barrow Vineyard looking out over Seneca Lake. And it was done with pastel sitting outside, very rough, very sort of impressionistic. If you look at it up close, it's like making a landscape with fat crayons. But from far away, because of my technique and ability and learned for years how to transcribe visual
signals,
it from far away it looked basically like a sort of panoramic photograph, and people would say, "Oh, what if yours in the winery is, can we look at?" So I would say, "Go look at the pastel," and they say, "Oh, you mean that photograph?" And I would make them go across the room to look at the surface of that pastel, because up close you can see that it was made like a cave painting. You know, it's with marks.
Do you feel like your work comes out of the blue, or are you really deliberate and you sit there and go, "I want to create what I'm seeing"?
No, I have found that my working method is to make marks and wipe them out and start over. And it basically, my work won't really start coming to life until I have sort of a bit of history. But what I wanted to say about the notion about looking at art is that I think because we are all looking so much at so many photographs, that the mere act of transcribing reality and making a pastel is no longer compelling, which is why I have learned at this moment that I have wanted and desire to figure out a way to capture and compel people to notice again the marks, which is why I have segued into my newest work, which is construction pieces, which is a combination basically of old found boards and old pieces of mantle and taken apart Victorian furniture combined with bits and pieces of my paintings and old books. And what I have found is that by sort of setting an operatic sort of theater for the same paintings that I did without it before, suddenly people will say, "Oh, what's going on? I want to look at this."
So you're almost answering the modern world with something more concrete in
some way. Well, I think that if I want to make statements, to make a communication, it means that I need to communicate. And I feel that I also have realized that what I might have seen as a compelling visual statement as a 21-year-old person versus 65, it's not going to be the same.
Yeah.
And it should, of necessity, reflect my changing viewpoint.
Yeah.
And I think that what I'm so excited about in my newest work is that the other thing that I had found a bit confining, and it was the haunting aspect that you responded to in the paintings, and that there was a sort of a lack of sort of lightness and levity, humor. And I basically feel, for me, paintings that overtly aspire to be funny aren't funny.
Mm.
But what had happened for me in 2014, I took a hiatus from my studio. And as a child, I had always, amongst catching frogs, I also put on puppet shows and staged theater extravaganzas.
Mm.
And I had made, as a child, all the puppets. They were hand puppets and they were marionettes. And so I was very involved. And what I did in 2014 is I ended up doing an adult comedic puppet show with a cadre of stand-up comedians that were in their 30s. And I made all the props and all the puppets, and it was presented one night. And
wow.
It basically was very changing in all forms for me, because it made me realize that I had been missing parts of my sort of exuberant joy in making artwork.
Mm.
Forging my way as a professional artist, there's economic pressures and sort of the outgrowth of what motivates us to become artists in the first place can get lost. And by staging
absolutely.
The evening with Rossini, sort of, which was a riff on La Cenerentola,
mm-hmm.
it brought me back to what all of making and sharing and communicating with an audience is about.
Do you think some of the seriousness of art, instead of, you know, finding the fun in it, has to do with you trying to unpeel your personality? Not just you, but as an artist. So in other words, you have to take yourself seriously.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that all the work I have ever done, I felt that I did all that I could at that time to make it as complete and compelling a statement as possible. I think that what I also did as an artist is that I very much purposefully did not want to become swayed by the vagaries of the fashionable New York art world.
Mm.
Because for me, it's the same thing happens in wine, that one doesn't want one's wine in a blind tasting to have somebody say, oh, that's just like a wonderful Pellini Montrachet. You want somebody to say, what a fabulous, unique wine that is in the style of Pellini Montrachet.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same way, you need and want your creation to be unique to you and to where you are, or else it's sort of more of, you know, it's just phases of, think about it in music, you know.
Yeah.
Roger Miller, there's one, you know, and if you're an artist that sounds like Roger Miller, that's who you sound like. You know, mm-hmm. you're not, you know, so that you need and want and should as an artist who's making a commitment to honesty.
Yeah, and then not just honesty, but artists do want to communicate, right? And you do want to have a dialogue.
Yes, although there are all kinds.
Yes.
I mean, I think there are people that, Emily Dickinson, you know, she wanted to communicate, but, you know, after she was long gone, you know, that it's, you know, they're all kinds of people in the world, and you know, certainly there are outsider artists that I admire that, you know, they aren't necessarily communicating for the same reason that Jackson Pollock was communicating.
You know, I was going to ask you too, do you enjoy the public aspect of art and milling with the people that are looking at your work? How do you feel about that?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I found it very curious because what people connect to is not necessarily what I had intended, but that isn't necessarily a problem to me. For instance, I'm thinking early on I did a painting that I entitled Signe's Dream. And Signe was my Swedish grandmother. And she had a very colorful, difficult life that involved three different husbands, and they were all very unique and distinct characters. And I called the painting that basically showed the setup was three different chairs with white cloths over them in an empty room. And so the title was sort of evocative of thinking about my grandmother's life and her three husbands. And so I had sold the painting. I was at an opening, and I was speaking to the collector who owned Signe's Dream, and I thought that it would be fun for them to know the story behind the painting. And it actually seemed to disturb them because they said, oh, we thought it was just a painting of chairs.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, but I would not want to necessarily say that he isn't capable of having a connection with the three chairs that don't involve my grandmother.
Yeah. I mean, people do have a unique connection to paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Every artist I've talked to said, whoa, I hadn't thought of that,
with
the way someone has perceived it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I find that really interesting. Do you like that aspect, though, of listening to people's versions in some ways?
I think that ultimately I do. I think that when I was teaching art, I taught for many years at Cornell and Ithaca College. I loved working with students, not all students, but when I had a great connection with the students, it was thrilling. And it challenged me to find really clear ways of being able to speak about basically a subject that is beyond words. And similarly, I feel that connecting with people that are viewing your work, it's a similar exercise. And I think, again, that's in part why I feel like my artwork has shifted.
We are almost out of time. Can you give some contact information? And tell us briefly if you have any exhibits coming up.
I do have an exhibit coming up at the Corners Gallery in July. It's a solo exhibition. The title is Tales from the Blue Ship Tea Room. The date's July 19th through August 31st.
Mm.
And
Contact information.
I have a website, which is fairly new. It's www.deborahbirmingham.com.
And
Birmingham
is
spelled B-E-R-M-I-N-G-H-A-M. And
great.
Deborah is D-E-B-R-A.
Thank you for joining us. It's been fascinating.
Great.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.